Hi everyone, I'm David. I support Gen X Grown Up on Patreon, and you should too. Don't you want to keep this great content coming? So you know what to do. Go to genxgrownup.com/Patreon and just do it.
No life, no fun. Don't you know that you're a grown up?
Gen X Grown Up is a YouTube channel, website, and audio podcast you're listening to right now. All made for and by people who love exploring media, games, tech, and toys of yesterday and today through the eyes of Gen Xers who refuse to grow up.
Your dinner cannot just be French fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown up.
Welcome back, Gen X Grown Up podcast listener, to this backtrack edition of the Gen X Grown Up podcast. I am John. Joining me, as always, of course, is George.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
You know that Mo is here with us.
Hey, everybody.
One of the many great things about growing up as Generation Xers is the caliber of our movies. A handful of talented directors honed their craft and brought us some truly great films during the late 70s and throughout the 80s. And few can say they delivered as many landmark movies as the subject of this backtrack, writer, producer, and director, John Landis. In fact, we spent an entire backtrack talking about John Landis' film, The Blues Brothers, which we'll touch on in a bit. And I see the ponderous thought on George's face. Before we get into the fourth listener email, let's go ahead and set this up. We were talking before the show. I'm not so sure how I feel about Landis anymore. Are you?
I know I don't like him.
Don't like him.
I don't like him. We'll talk about it as we get into it. It's not just going back and rewatching some of these films. There are some things that we're going to get into about him specifically when we talk about one film that
personally,
now that I've learned more and more looking back through documentaries and other stuff, that I just don't like him.
Yeah. I made a lot of realizations during the course of preparing for this backtrack that we're going to dig into most assuredly. First, though, it is time for a quick look at the mailbag fourth listener email. There's three of us. We know we're going to listen. If anybody else listens, you're the fourth listener. And we have two fourth listeners, which I guess is that fourth and
fifth?
We have
a fifth listener.
They're both fourth.
They're both fourth. They're tied for fourth.
Yeah, new math.
Yeah. Well, they both wrote in about the same backtrack.
Oh, okay. So that counts. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So that's why you put them together.
Yeah.
Ryan L. wrote in. The subject line of his email was TV and movie cars, talking about the backtrack we did just a month or so ago, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Ryan says, I've loved cars most of my life, and a lot of that comes from the cars as characters I grew up with. Your episode made me dig deep into my memory to think about what would top my list.
Okay.
I love what it makes people think about their own, like, what would my picks be?
So, especially because that last segment we did where we each picked our favorite.
Yeah, your favorites. Yeah. Right. And you picked the goofy Mr. Bean car.
Why are you calling Mr.
Bean? It is a goofy car.
Don't shame on Mr. Bean.
There's nothing wrong with saying goofy. I think goofy's a compliment in that case.
Okay.
That's right. Let's pretend it was a compliment. Exactly.
Let's pretend.
So Ryan says, setting aside the icons listed, my pick is Rhodey from the mostly forgotten Pole Position cartoon.
Holy crap.
That was definitely forgotten. Because that did not last long.
What a deep cut. Yeah. He said his partner, Wheels, was basically a cartoon 65-ish Mustang, but Rhodey was from the future. And 40 years later, no car manufacturer has come close to give me anything like it.
Very true.
I had to go dig up some episodes of Pole Position because I saw that email. I'm like, oh my God, I forgot there was a Pole Position cartoon.
I mean, it only lasts like one season, right?
I think so. Yeah.
You know, it's like 15 episodes. Most of those 80s or 70s cartoons, though, they lasted one season. They just kept doing repeats all the time.
And I thought they were all new. I didn't know the difference.
Yeah.
So thank you, Ryan. The other fourth listener that wrote in, also subject line Gen X TV and movie cars, is Ted. Thank you for writing in, Ted.
Hey, Ted.
Yeah. Ted says, love the episode. You guys nailed it.
Wow.
Oh, we nailed one.
Holy crap. About time. Only took us 120.
Just about.
Times two.
Yeah.
That's right. You had everything from the era. Except, Oh, maybe we didn't nail it.
Yeah,
apparently.
We didn't nail it. Yeah.
You missed the Lamborghini Countach.
I mean, it was
a movie or TV.
Is it featured a particular? Here's what he says. Let's go on and see. Okay. Let's not wander. Let's keep reading Ted's email and say.
All right.
The exotic car of every red-blooded boy's fantasy. Obviously, I had a poster in my room of Lamborghini, of course.
I did not, but okay.
Who didn't have the poster right beside the Maxell blown away on their wall? Well, I'd never had a Maxell poster, but definitely had a Lamborghini.
Yep. I had neither. I I think I had Heather Locklear. What else did I have?
I don't know. I might have had Heather Locklear on a Lamborghini. I'm not sure. It's been a while.
You didn't have the Farrah Fawcett poster? I had that one. That was a good poster.
I didn't have the Farrah Fawcett poster. Heather Locklear was the taller one that had the pink bikini. I don't know. Mm-hmm, we're going right down a tangent now. That's all that's a different podcast.
Welcome to the Backtrack Gen about X posters from the 80s. Posters.
Yeah. Don't ask George, like, what do you have for dinner last night? But ask what color bikini.
There's a bikini on the poster. He knows. Yeah. So he doesn't quote a particular TV or movie. It just kind of permeated, I guess, you know, culture, I guess.
It was a pretty much, it was like on posters. It was everywhere.
Yeah. So it didn't come up as our top TV and movie cars, although it was featured. It wasn't like focused from one particular movie or TV. So right, fair enough, Ted. He says, still, you're batting 950, so don't get too down on yourselves.
Okay.
That's a sports thing, right, George?
I appreciate the permission to not feel bad about something that wasn't in a TV or movie.
You're welcome. He says, you are my appointment podcast. Keep up the excellent work. Cheers, Ted.
Awesome. That's cool.
Cheers? Really?
Cheers.
Ted Danson, cheers?
Cheers.
I think that might have been coincidental, but maybe not. Okay, we'll pretend.
It was really smart if it was planned. He did a great job.
Hey, Ted, you're batting 950 on your references. Good job. Thank you, Ryan and Ted, for writing in. We love it every time the fourth listener hears the show and decides they want to write in and tell us what they think about it. We love that. If you'd like your email featured here on the show, it's easy. Just hit us up at podcast@genxgrownup.com. We read every single one, and most of them, like Ryan's and Ted's, eventually make the show. All right, we're going to find out why George and maybe I aren't as big a fan of John Landis as we thought we were when we get into the meat of this backtrack right after this break. Over the past few weeks, we've been trying out Factor Meals and their meals that come straight to your door. They deliver them to you in the mail. They drop on the front door in this freezer pack. And it's a great way to eat stress-free. And this spring, you can get delicious, ready-to-eat meals. They're fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted, and dietitian-approved. And here's the cool thing, as we've all found out. You throw them in the microwave for 2 minutes, and they're ready to eat and not even requiring cleanup.
And if you can't find something on their menu that you like, then you're just way too picky. Mm-hmm. Because they have over 35 options. Mm. You know, they have things like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, Vegan, Veggie, and we even tried the vegetarian one, which was really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just the regular meals, but they've also got all these add-on packs, which I really love. These are things like, you know, breakfast or on-the-go lunches or little snacks, even like beverages that want to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So really, I mean, like they say on their site, what are you waiting for? And they're not kidding. You can get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals by heading over to Factor.
Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals so you can get back to doing what you love this spring.
Are you looking for good gourmet meals? Try the meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus.
Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savor the good stuff.
Customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. Pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle.
Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking.
We're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for lowest carbon footprint meals.
So head to factormeals.com/GenX50 and use code GenX50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code GenX50 at factormeals.com/GenX50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Be sure to subscribe to or follow Gen X Grown Up wherever you listen. And while you're there, rate and review the show, too. It helps more than you know.
From the dawn of man comes Schluck. A beast from 20 million years ago stalks the streets of today. A love stranger than King Kong. A monster more powerful than Godzilla. See, a small California town learn the true meaning of terror.
Call out the National Guard.
Oh, this is going to be the best sense.
In this backtrack, we are focusing on the Gen X era films of legendary director John Landis. And I mentioned at the head, you know, maybe we have differing opinions of him. We think maybe not all of his stuff held up as well, but we're going to get into all of that. Let's start by talking about the man before we get into particular films we've selected.
Oh, sure. I mean, so I did a little research on this. So he was born in Chicago, which makes sense since most of his movies take place in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
August 3rd, 1950. Mm-hmm. It was said that he was inspired to go into directing from watching the Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. You remember that one? The Harryhausen?
Oh. Stop motion, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Harryhausen stuff with the skeletons. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. You see, he worked as a gopher for 20th Century Fox. So obviously he wanted to get into that business early on in his life.
Foot in the door.
Seems like that was a way that a lot of guys got into the film business during back that then. Era in the 60s, 70s. They started off as gophers, peons, set people going to get stuff, whatever.
Grip,
and then
whatever
next thing
is.
You know, somebody... yep. talks them into, you know, they talk somebody, I've got this great idea for a movie. Give me $500,000. Okay. You got my coffee.
Yeah. Well, you're not too far off actually, because.
Yeah, I think that is what happened kind of. Because this is something I didn't realize, that he was actually an assistant director for Kelly's Heroes.
The World War II TV show?
About the robbery with Telly Savalas, Don Rickles, all those guys were in it.
Oh, the original film.
The film.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, I'm thinking of Hogan's Heroes.
Oh, that's that's a TV show. No, the movie.
I see nothing except John Landis. Right?
Yeah, that show would not be made today. And he replaced the film's original assistant director, who became ill and was sent home. Mysterious circumstances.
Maybe he gave him the bad coffee with the spoiled creamer.
Gopher, get me some coffee. Oh, here's your coffee, buddy.
And his first film, he directed his first movie when he was 21, and it was called Schlock, which he wrote and shot in 1971. I don't know that much about that movie. I saw the poster. I thought this may be something John may have seen. I don't know. Right. Have you seen this one?
You know, I have never seen it. However, as soon as I saw the poster in my research for this John Landis backtrack, I need to find this film. So first, it's a stupid parody film, but it's basically a Bigfoot movie in disguise. So it's right up my alley.
How is it that you keep working Bigfoot into all these damn podcasts?
He's everywhere you want to be, man. Bigfoot is there. So in the movie, Schlock is a prehistoric ape man, and he ends up terrorizing a Southern California town because obviously some kids ended up in his cave and disturbed him, and he comes out and wreaks havoc. It was written, directed, and starred John Landis.
Okay.
Yeah, you're setting this thing up for success.
He was Schlock. He was the guy in the ape suit.
Good Lord.
Somebody had to do it.
Yeah, it was a parody of like old monster movies. It was meant to be goofy.
Oh, okay.
They shot it in 12 days outside of the LA area with a budget of $60,000.
Wow.
And most of that came from Landis's personal savings.
I was going to ask, who gave him the money?
No, nobody.
Nobody.
Not like you go out in the woods dressed up like an ape man. You're not getting my money.
Yeah, no. And it's a parody on top of all that.
Right on top of that. Right. Well, so he wrote it in 71. He shot it in 72, but he couldn't get it distributed. Nope. I guess not a big surprise, probably.
Couldn't
get it distributed.
I got the best movie ever.
How many copies do you think he had for $60,000? He only had like five reels that he was running around in his car with or something, I'm sure.
Probably. He's probably carrying around with him.
Well, one way or another, Johnny Carson caught wind of this goofy little movie, and he had John Landis on the show, and they showed clips of it.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and so after that, it got released theatrically in the U.S. in 1973, thanks to Johnny Carson stepping in to this young, unknown director. At the time was, what'd you say, Mo, in his 20s, 21, 22?
Yeah, 21. He's early still in his early 20s at that point.
Oh, man.
I mean, so it had the one thing that if you got in the 1970s, made your career, and that's the stamp of Carson, right? We see it with comedians. We see it with actors. We see it with this director now. If Carson put you on a show, liked you, talked you up a little bit, you were golden in your career for the next 20 years.
Okay, here's something. I had to look up the Rotten Tomatoes in this movie because I was just curious.
Did you have to?
Tomato meter? 71%.
Look at that.
Now, the audience score was 44%.
That's like three voters, and they're all John's friends and cronies in the Sasquatch Movement Club or something.
Well, if they were all my cronies, that would be 100%. So clearly somebody poisoned the well.
Yeah.
Well, somebody didn't like Landis, so.
Oh, maybe that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
I've never seen it, but now 70-something percent?
Yeah, 71.
Now I have to. Oh, now I have to see it.
No, you don't.
I do. It might be the best one we talk about today. I don't. That's not true. That's
it's
going
to be a next podcast. He's like, I know what mine's going to be.
We're going to talk all about Schlock.
Schlock.
Schlock, that was the beginning of his career, though. So we're going to move into, we're really focusing on the Gen X era films. We've talked about the man. Now we've selected a handful of his most notable films from the 70s and early 80s. And we're going to dig into all of those, both what we think about them, what we like, what we don't like, and what we thought of them looking back at them after all these years. And we're getting started right after the break. Stick around.
Hello, and welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo, and for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book. And together, we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our ninth season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Gen X Grown Up. But if you have a friend who's not yet listening, why not? Tell them about us. They'll thank you later.
The Kentucky Fried movie heralds the return to traditional values.
I'm not wearing any pants. Film at 11.
It is a film of heartfelt passion, a great love story.
Oh, take me to the drive and prove you love me.
It explores the subtle nuances of interpersonal relationships.
I don't want to keep bringing this subject up because I don't want to talk about Bigfoot or Sasquatch or Yeti or anything else with John.
It's okay. But go ahead.
No, you don't bring it up.
The first film that we're going to talk about in this group of 70s films of John Landis, Kentucky Fried Movie from 1971.
Oh, yeah.
There's a segment where one of the characters, because Kentucky Fried Movie, it's all these different clips and stuff, you know, and there's one of the segments of the film where a guy goes into a movie theater. On that movie theater, there was a damn poster of Schlock. I didn't know Schlock was his movie until we started talking about it for this podcast. I only recognized it because I said, oh, look, there's a damn Sasquatch poster in Kentucky Fried Movie. John's going to talk about it. So,
oh, man,
I hadn't made that connection. Oh, man.
That's awesome.
Now, George, you said you had not seen this film before prepping for this show, right?
Yeah, that's very true. It came out in 77. I was 6 years old when it came out. Obviously, didn't see it. John, you were 8. Mo, that made you 10, I'm guessing, when this film came out.
I doubt any of us saw it in the theater.
Yeah, I did not.
I'm sure we didn't. I only heard about this movie later on during the VHS rental era that happened in the early to mid 80s, where it really started taking off. And the only reason I heard about it was because other friends of mine had rented it and came to me in school and said, hey, you need to go see this movie. It's got lots of boobs.
It doesn't have a lot of them, but they're front and center when they're there. That's true.
Well, first 1977 for a kid in the early 80s.
That's a lot.
After watching this movie now, there's a lot of boobs in that movie for the era. There's a
I
lot
guess
of boobage.
So. Yeah, there's a couple other scenes.
Like boobs per minute, BPM. It was pretty high on the index.
Well, in case you're like George and haven't seen it, Kentucky Fried Movie, it's not really a movie. It's not a story. It's a series of unconnected sketches that parody film genres and other stuff. There's one, a couple of them are like exploitation films.
Yep.
There's one that's like a kung fu themed film. It's half the movie almost. Kind of softcore porn is those are boobs per minute came in there. It's a bunch of goofy little sketches thrown together. And it was a collaboration with Zucker Abram Zucker, the Zazz team, the people that later did Naked Gun and Airplane and things like that. Same guys. And this is one of the ones we're going to talk about that I did not have to go back and rewatch. I have watched this enough for all of us repeatedly.
After having watched it one time, I have one question for you. Why? Why would you go back and watch this film? It's awful.
I watched it again. I laughed still, actually.
See?
I mean, there we go. I'm not going to say they're not funny lines, one-liners mainly, or slightly funny segments, but this movie does not stand up to the test of time.
I, I mean, I think a lot of the references are old, which makes it just kind of dated.
Sure. There's the president coming into office at that time. He was a Democrat. And there's the OPEC stuff that was going on, the oil embargoes and whatnot.
Which probably made it a little bit harder. I watched it again and it's still cracked. I don't know. I still laughed. I still thought it was funny.
Wow. I chuckled.
It's George. It's what do you want out of a movie? Like, there's not a great story in this
film. Zero story.
There's not great cinematography. There's not great performances. It's just people being goofy. And a lot of, like, Bill Bixby is in it briefly.
Yeah,
Donald
Sutherland.
All these little, Donald Sutherland, all these little people sprinkled
James
in around.
James Bond was in this movie.
Roger Moore?
No, George Lazenby.
James Bond.
That's how bad the movie was. It couldn't even rate Roger Moore. It could only get George Lazenby.
Yeah. I still enjoyed it after rewatch. I did rewatch it. I haven't seen this one in years. And it's definitely one of those, like, in college, like, student union movies and stuff like that, that they had. Like, this was one of the movies that they had there. It just reminded me a lot of Airplane, obviously, because it's, you know, similar writers, similar style.
Sure.
I just found it funny. I don't know. I just laughed.
That's why I watch it. It's one of those things that we call ironing movies, right? It's like, I can, while I'm ironing clothes, I can put this on in the background because I can see it without looking at it. I know every scene.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just the goofy little sketches. And I'll poke around the corner. I want to see this part. Oh, I want to see. We are building a fighting force of extraordinary magnitude. You know, I want to see the fistful of yen or something. It's goofy, goofy stuff.
These men don't know who they are and don't care. I mean, come on.
don't care.
I will say that I loved all the digs they put at Enter the Dragon. Because obviously fistful of yen is Enter the Dragon.
Yeah, right. Big time.
Mm-hmm. I loved all the little jokes. The best one for me was how they kept reusing, "You have our gratitude. Because that was one of the lines that friends of mine, when we talked about watching Enter the Dragon the first times, we love Enter the Dragon, but that line, corny as hell from the original movie.
Yep. Yeah.
I love that they made fun of it in the parody. It needed to be made fun of.
It is. Yep. Before we get out of Kentucky Fried Movie, there's a little trivia that I've always loved. I forget where I first learned it years ago, but Landis had a different initial name for this film, and both of them got rejected by the distributors because they feared that having these names on the marquee at the theater would cause confusion.
Okay.
The first name he had was Free Popcorn. Okay. All right. You can see the problem there.
Yeah.
And the other one was Closed for Remodeling.
Yep.
Talk about putting a bullet in your own foot at the opening of your theater.
Genius.
But it would have been brilliant if they would have allowed it. But yeah,
And so just the chaos of Free Popcorn, but it says out front. No.
That's the name of the movie. Sorry.
Like, you could do that these days, and that would put that movie on a skyrocket. It would make $1 billion day one just from one of those two names, because it would be all over the internet. Like,
people talk about it.
It'd be memes everywhere. People be talking about it. It's an okay film. There's some funny one-liners in it, a couple of segments. I did like the love record segment. That was
Big
funny.
Jim Slade.
Every record comes with Big Jim. He bursts through the door.
And it's got like, dun, it's like a march in the background. Dun, right. Dun, 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 dun.
And especially when he takes the woman out of the house through the door. They leave. And the guy left on the bed, the husband or whatever, he's like, bye. He's just like, okay, thanks, record. I appreciate it.
The record guaranteed satisfaction, and she got it. So there you go.
For the record, too, this did get a Rotten Tomatoes score at 81.
There you go.
Which is pretty respectable.
Christ. More of my cronies, George, voting on Rotten Tomatoes for me. Thank you.
Wow.
The other 70s film that we're going to talk about, also a John Landis production, Rotten Tomatoes score of 90, so you'd had to make our list to talk about, and that is National Lampoon's Animal House.
Great
star
movie.
Vehicle for John Belushi. Oh, man.
Oh, yeah.
A synopsis is, a 1962 college, Dean Vernon Warmer is determined to expel the entire Delta Tau Chi fraternity, but those troublemakers have other plans for him. Yeah, they do.
One of the great Kevin Bacon game movies.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody's in that movie.
A lot of links for Kevin Bacon through this film. Yep. I still, to this day, I love this film. I think I've seen it maybe, I don't know, 20 times over the course of my life. Probably watch it once every 5 years or so. Mm. It's a fun film. I'm not going to say it stood the test of time if you watched it new, but if you watched it a lot, like John did with Kentucky Fried Chicken, this is one of those same kind of films that holds you, and you can ironing while you're watching the movie and see all the scenes for me.
Yeah, I know this one holds a special place for you, Mo. I think you said this is one of your dad's favorite films. He cracked it, especially with the horse, right? Where they just freeze frame him?
Yeah, because, it's an R-rated movie, right? I'm 11 when this movie comes out. Mm-hmm. My dad comes home having seen it and tells me, you have to see this movie. And my brother takes me to go see it the next day. And I was like, Dad, this R. He's like, no. And all you gotta do is mention the horse scene, the horse having a heart attack, and my dad would just crack up every single time. He just, I don't know why. That just hit him right the right spot to make him laugh.
There's something about the over-the-topness of the acting in this film that for me makes it not as good as I remember. I rewatched it in preparation for this show. I'm like, all right, I'm gonna watch Animal House. It's gonna be great. And I'm not sure it's great anymore.
Like, so how are you going to call this film out for overacting and you're happy and okay with Kentucky Fried Movie? Because that's all that was.
Well, that was supposed to be overacted, though. That was supposed to be overacted.
Overacting was the point of that one, I think.
Animal House had that as part of its point, too, I think.
But it was trying to be a real movie, too. And so, like, it doesn't hold up as a real movie because it's trying to be. Whereas the other one was just being goofy sketches. You know, it's... It is subjective. I just didn't enjoy this as much, even as Kentucky Fried.
I mean, I'm not trying to say the movie holds up today because I don't. I don't think it does. But if it's one of those that you loved when it came out, I think it is easier to hold in my heart than Kentucky Fried Movie would have been. But it's hard to say because I didn't watch that movie back then. So,
yeah, you know, right. You don't have that frame of reference.
Sure. Yeah.
I rewatch it. It was still funny to me. This one was still cracked me up, too, just because, I mean, John Belushi was great in this one.
He was.
Yeah, he was the star of this. Whether he was meant absolutely. To be or not, he was. Yeah.
I mean, he had like 3 lines in the whole movie, maybe 4 lines, but it was great. And just the whole, I don't know, it's just the absurdity of it was just really funny.
And that these adult men were in college still, right? They had older guys playing these college students. Yeah. But you're right, John Belushi, what he can do with just a look, just raising his eyebrow and that goofy knowing grin is like, oh, we're off to the races because he's going to do something fun. And he draws me into the film more than anybody else.
Yeah,
he definitely does. I think it's a movie that the star of the movie was, it's kind of like Caddyshack in that regard. Bill Murray was not meant to be the star of that film.
But
Murray's scenes are the one that everybody talks about later on, right? And I think that's the same way with Belushi and Animal House. And I'm not 100% convinced that these films are successful because of John Landis. I am more convinced that these films of his that are successful because of the actors in front of the camera, maybe even taking over and doing their own thing, more than him being a quote-unquote director. I don't know if either of you are going to agree with that as we go through these, but...
It's hard to say. I guess, I mean, I see where you're coming from. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The thing is also, I mean, there are directors that allow that kind of stuff too and are willing to listen and willing to let people be themselves, like to know, like just get out of the way and let John Belushi be John Belushi, like the whole cafeteria scene. I mean, again, you know, just let him just do what he's going to do. But, you know, is it that because he's really good at casting and then he can just sit back and relax after
that? But he didn't cast. That's something I've watched in a lot of documentaries lately. Directors almost never are the casting decision makers. It's often the casting agents.
But even more so back then, and we'll talk about what we get later. There's a particular film we're going to talk about that brought into question the great control that directors had over their films, is that he is the captain of the ship. If the movie is good, he gets the credit. If the movie is not, he gets the blame.
True.
And especially back in the 70s and early 80s, that was very much true. Directors had a lot of power over the films, more so than the studios did sometimes. Yep. So even if it wasn't his talents that did it, he was at the helm. And so he gets the credit for it.
Well, and as we're finding out in retrospect with a lot of things that have happened in the last 5 years or so, that's not always a good thing that these directors have this much power.
No. You're right. So, all right. When we get back from the break, we're finally moving into one of our favorite decades, the 80s. And we're going to start up with the John Landis films of the early 80s. Stick around.
Coming up on 5-Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5-Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.
Each episode of Gen X Grown Up has show notes loaded with links where you can learn more about our topics. And there's even more to see and hear over at genxgrownup.com.
I had the most absurd nightmare. I was poor and no one liked me.
I know what you're thinking. You see Foggy and Beth? We can make it, baby! Me and you!
Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy are trading places.
Help! Help!
I don't want your bag, man.
Help! Help!
John Landis kicked off the early 80s. You know, he knew a winner when he saw one. He had John Belushi, so he brought John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd in, coincidentally, together to work on the Blues Brothers in 1980.
Okay.
Now, he didn't bring them together. That was written for them together. Right. But he's the captain. He gets the credit for that.
I'm not giving him the credit for that one. They came up with those characters themselves on SNL.
That's true. But he was the boss of that film. Now, I don't want to dive into the Blues Brothers here. We spent an entire backtrack on the Blues Brothers. We know the synopsis. You know, Jake and Elwood have to save the orphanage where they grew up, and tons of musical acts, and just of the Landis films, probably my favorite. Definitely, I think my favorite, probably of all of Landis films.
For me too.
If you want detailed notes about this film, go back and see our previous entry, The Blues
That's
Brothers.
Right. That's right.
I'll throw a link in our show notes, right? Directly take you right to that
full
podcast.
Dedicated backtrack to that one. So I'm not going to retread that ground. Blues Brothers in 1980. So let's move along. What's the next one we're going to touch on?
So let's jump next year, 1981. I mean, he was pumping out movies like crazy. An American Werewolf in London.
Oh, okay.
Remember, that came out in 81.
We're going to talk about American Werewolf in London. I'm happy because did really like this film.
Well, good. Well, Rotten Tomatoes, 88, just so you know. So you're in good company.
It deserves it. And Mo, give the synopsis real quick, too, in case somebody out there hasn't seen it.
So this one, two American college students on a walking tour of Britain are attacked by a werewolf, and none of the locals will admit that werewolves exist.
Yeah.
And hilarity ensues at the next full moon.
Hilarity. That's a big word for this film. I love this film. When I first saw it when I was a kid, I think I saw this film probably around 85, 86, something like that at that point. It was, at that time, my favorite werewolf or monster movie of all time, of all my movies that I had seen, which was probably, 40 movies at that point. I wasn't like I was really into my movie watching career. It didn't hold up. I hate to say it. I just rewatched it today as we're recording this thing. They tried to do some controversial things in there. The whole dream sequences that they went back and forth with as he was trying to recover from his injuries and all. I know I felt like they did that a little too often to prove a point that they had already proved. The quick love interest felt forced. I don't know. Just didn't work for me as well. I still love the movie. Just didn't work as well.
You know, two things struck me in watching American Werewolf again. The first is that when we saw this in the 80s, this was a horror film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Watching it now, this doesn't feel like a horror film at all.
No.
It's a drama, kind of, right?
Like comedy, maybe.
Character study.
A little bit. Yeah. A little bit. Yeah. There you go. Yeah, there's nothing jarringly scary in it. The attacks are very brief and very predictable. And because they're using, I love practical makeup effects, especially his victims who are decaying and decomposing and you see them as they die.
Yep.
Love that stuff about it. But I noticed so much of the special effects was done in camera and during editing. Like the guy's being chased through the subway by the werewolf.
Okay.
And you almost never see him.
I'm gonna get to that scene in a minute.
You see the guy running and there's a werewolf somewhere, I guess. And then later you see him briefly. But today that would be, you would see the werewolf slamming against walls and skittering around.
Oh, sure. CGI.
And now it's just like, pretend the werewolf is there. You just had to assume. Quick cuts and quick edits to make you think horrible things were happening that weren't.
Yeah, I think he's trying to pull the whole Jaws thing, right? Where you don't really see the shark a whole lot, but you didn't have to. And I think that's because Spielberg, I think, is a much better director and was able to pull it off a lot better.
Right?
Let's be honest. And when I watched it, I mean, I get what you're saying. The thing that got me was the dialogue seemed very odd. It had a weird pace to it for me. Like when I was listening to it, it just seemed like, I don't know, it just seemed like just weird. Like the way we were speaking, like it didn't seem natural. But I thought the funniest parts for me were like listening to the dead people, like the people he was going to kill and all that stuff. They were hilarious. And their dialogue was great. Yeah, but I get what you're saying.
So I want to dive into a couple of things on this film because it does hold such a place in my heart. But Mo's exactly right. The dialogue is terrible.
Stilted.
Stilted at the beginning. Yeah. Mm-hmm. David Nottingham, who plays the lead character, the werewolf, you know, the guy who gets attacked and becomes a werewolf. There are two films of his that I like during this period. American Werewolf in London. There's another one that most people don't like called Hot Dog the Movie. TNA film about people on the ski slope. He's the main character in that one as well.
Okay.
I think because of this movie, they said, let's put him in another vehicle and see if he's a star. He was way better in that film with his dialogue and his line delivery than he was in this film. It's not even close. Another thing, John, you talked about that subway scene. Mm-hmm. Is that not the most least athletic human being in England at the time?
Well, he's British.
Gee,
with the umbrella and all
now
that.
Now we're going to get emails. Thanks. But he, like he can barely walk. He stumbles on the escalator, throws his briefcase into the air, gets a bloody nose, and then he just lays there for what seemed there like with a werewolf 10 after minutes. Him. I'm like, didn't work at all. And it's another example of something I think Landis doesn't do well, because he wrote and directed this film. Mm-hmm. I don't think he does action well at all. That scene needed more action in order to make you feel scared, like you talked about.
No, John, terror.
This
no.
was supposed to be a horror film, we thought back then. Mm-hmm. Back then. We see it now. There's nothing scary because of scenes like this.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. Yeah. What's the other point?
Well, the other thing I think is that at the end of the movie, the resolution, mm-hmm. he talks with Griffin Dunne in the theater, and Griffin Dunne and the people, as Mo said, they were hilarious. You know, you mm-hmm. killed me, blah, blah, blah. We yeah. don't want to talk to you. Yeah. They were funny. But then, you know, he's tearing off his clothes in the theater. Everybody get out. John, you talk about the practical effects in scene. I think Mo's right on that he tried to do what Spielberg did with Jaws, but mm-hmm. there were better films that did this same kind of thing mm-hmm. where you don't see the monster, like Alien, right? Around this time period mm-hmm. where yeah. you never see the alien. And when you do, it scares the ever-loving crap out of you, yeah. right?
You don't have to see it because the music and scene, all that make
exactly.
that's creepy enough, right?
I think the makeup effects in this one, everybody knows mm-hmm. the transformation scene.
Awesome. Yeah. Yep.
It was an awesome yep. achievement first cool. day.
It kind of doesn't hold up great these days, no. even for other practical effects, but it was still awesome for the time and yeah, yeah. very but pivotal.
Every yeah. single attack scene in this movie is fucking comical.
Yawn.
They are terrible. Yep. It's yep. It looks like just a wolf's head smacking somebody around yeah. that somebody's got yep. on a broomstick or something. It's awful. They were terrible.
It definitely was.
And it's kind of like I feel like with Jaws. Jaws was best when you didn't see the shark. When you finally did see the shark at the end of the movie, you're like, that just looks like a model with gaskets that aren't working right.
Yeah. Which it was.
So I don't think Landis did a great job with this film. That's kind of where I'm going.
This is one that I would love to see a modern remake of, because actually, I love yeah. the approach where it's everybody idea, knows yeah. werewolves exist. Mm-hmm. People even tell him, he's like, oh, I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. And then it starts to happen to him. I love the analytical approach, the angle that it took, but it just didn't hold up for me like I remember it. It's just not a horror movie anymore.
Yeah. I could see a remake of this and be happy with it. There are films I don't want you to touch in remakes. This is one I could see.
This one could use it.
A couple, yeah. my last two things on this is, one is like, yeah, they absolutely should do a remake on this one.
That'd be great.
My favorite part of this movie actually was the idea that the people he kills don't die, right? Or not mm-hmm. completely
They're
die.
They're in limbo, right?
They're in limbo, yeah, which I think is awesome. And here's a little trivia thing I found. The nurse, the character who plays the nurse.
Uh-huh. Jenny Agutter.
You have all seen her in a movie not that long ago, which was Winter Soldier.
Yeah, Winter Soldier.
She's one of the S.H.I.E.L.D.'s heads. Mm-hmm.
She's on the, oh. not S.H.I.E.L.D., she's the head of the governing body that S.H.I.E.L.D.
Right.
listens to, yeah.
Huh. That was actually her. So I was like, oh, cool. Yeah. But yeah,
and she had been in stuff before this, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Logan's Run, most notably.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yep.
Different the last thing I noted was a casting item. You know, Frank Oz was in the Blues Brothers. He was the guy, he was the property master at the prison right. when John Belushi's character was getting out.
Stand behind right?
And he's yeah. like, one hat, black, one suit, black, red, all that stuff. Frank Oz had a brief appearance in this film. He was the guy from the American Embassy when the guy mm-hmm. first wakes up in the hospital. And I'm watching, I'm like, is that Frank Oz? Holy crap, it is. He's in a bunch
Kessler.
Of movies.
Mr. Kessler. Yes. There's no reason to for hysterics. Mr. Kessler.
Yeah. Yep. And apparently Frank Oz is in the John Landis Repertory Company, because he pops up again and again in his films. We'll come across him again. But all right, let's move along from America Werewolf. Fine film, not a horror any longer. Let's move on into, I think, one of the great classics of the mid-80s, Trading Places.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
Yes.
I'll give absolutely. You that one.
Yep.
Love this one.
1983. Rotten Tomatoes gave it an 88. I don't know. Probably the audience probably gave it 102.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's damn low.
Yeah. Trading Places, great film. If you haven't seen it, what are you doing listening to a Gen X podcast? You should be watching that film. But
it holds up
a
well.
A snobbish investor and a wily street con artist find their positions reversed as part of a bet by two callous millionaires. Right? So you got Dan Aykroyd and you got Eddie Murphy. And I should mention Jamie Lee Curtis as a notable yes. cameo in this film. Well worth
well,
watching.
That was a cameo. That was like actually,
well, right, an appearance. Right, right. Yeah, yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah.
What a cool. Watching absolutely. This again was easy. A treat.
Yeah. So, yeah, I agree. It was really easy. And I think something that you mentioned earlier, George, which I think probably takes effect here, is like, I think the reason why this was so good is that he let Eddie Murphy be Eddie Murphy in this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that carried, I mean, Eddie Murphy carried the movie. I mean, even Dan Aykroyd's character, I don't think did as nearly as good a job as Eddie no. Murphy's character. Pretty much all the movies I saw, this one held up the best, I think.
So, Mo, I'm going to go back to something you said. You said he let Eddie Murphy be Eddie Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I agree with that statement. I think Eddie Murphy just took over his damn movie.
Well, that's a big supposition.
But Eddie Murphy is known for that, though, with Beverly Hills Cop and all kinds of films. Even later on, we're going to talk about another Landis and Eddie Murphy collaboration. And I've watched documentaries about this one that we're going to talk about at the end, and they got into big fights on that set because Murphy said, nope, we're doing it this way. And Landis was like, nope, I'm doing it my way. And Murphy won. And thank God he did, because
Also early in his acting career too. I mean, he was still like, this was one of his breakout movies, wasn't it?
It was, but he was already super widely popular because of SNL. Remember, when he came into films, he didn't ask to make films. They asked him to go to movies. It was a different thing than like when Belushi and Aykroyd did the Blues Brothers. That was Lorne Michaels, right? Hey, we need you guys to make a movie because these characters are popular. But Eddie Murphy, this wasn't supposed to be an SNL thing.
I mean, I don't know. Like I said, I don't know, but it's just from looking at previous movies and stuff, it seems like he does let, when he has like really good talent, I think he lets him do what they got to do.
More relaxed form of storytelling. I got to say that. If Eddie Murphy's presence created better storytelling for the whole movie, good on him. But I got to give Landis a little bit of credit here. If he's in charge of this film, if he didn't fight Murphy on it, whatever happened, it turned out to be a more cohesive film that holds up better and was told better.
I'm not going to give him credit because of what we're going to talk about next, because you guys keep saying he's in charge of the film and he lets people do what they want. The next film is a classic example of a director doing way the wrong things for way the wrong reasons and real consequences coming out of it. I don't think that Landis deserves the credit that you guys are giving him, that he lets these people do. I don't think Landis is, I just don't like him. I said it at the beginning of the podcast.
If you're going to give
it.
Him the blame for the bad things that happen, part of you has got to give him some credit for the good things that happen. It might just be one side. He's either responsible or not.
That means I have to say, well, it was a Holocaust, but at least he organized Germany, so Hitler's okay. No.
That is not what I said at all.
That is
not even close to
a good argument. That is
you're saying if I give him credit for the bad stuff, I have to give him credit for the good stuff.
I'm saying if something comes out good.
Now we're doing a Gen X grown-up debate episode.
Okay, I won't fight you on that, but I will say that I disagree that he can't just be held responsible for the bad things and not get credit for things that turned out well. So it's either responsible or not, one of the other.
I don't think they have to be mutually exclusive. I think both things can be true.
I think both things are true. That's the point.
I want them to be true.
You just made my point. Yes.
I'm talking about my two opinions, not your two.
Not my two opinions. All right. All right. I think we've finished praising Trading Places. Why don't we go ahead, George, and segue into what you want to talk about. In fact, 1983, another film, same year.
Yeah, same year.
Yeah. Twilight Zone, the movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If anybody listening to this podcast hadn't picked up on what we were going to talk about, again, right. Like John said, what are you doing listening to our podcast? Go back and watch some 80s films. I'll give you the synopsis. Four horror and science fiction segments directed by four famous directors of the time, each of them being a new version of a classic story from Rod Serling's landmark television series, The Twilight Zone.
Yep.
So I have a lot of twisted emotions about this film. When I first saw the film as a younger person, not knowing what really happened because I didn't watch news or anything like that, and there were only three news channels. Anyway, I didn't understand everything that went on with this movie. At the time, I really liked this film. I really enjoyed the four different segments. I still remember them all to this day.
So as you said, George, four different directors directed parts of this film. And so we could talk about the whole film, but mainly we're going to focus on what John Landis did. And he did the prologue, which was the little bit at the beginning where Dan Aykroyd and this other guy were in a car together and they pull over. You want to see something really scary?
Yeah.
Yeah, let me see. And he attacks him. It's just a little quick snippet. But then the main thing, the segment, one of the four stories, Landis did the first one. It was called Time Out, and it was a remake of A Quality of Mercy from the original Twilight Zone series. That is the one starring Vic Morrow that we're talking about here that actually went sideways during production.
And so we now know through courtroom cases and documentaries and eyewitness accounts and things that essentially Landis made decisions that got three people killed. That's what it boils down to. I'm not going to sugarcoat it, and I don't care if anybody disagrees with me or not. he got three people killed because he made poor decisions based on what he wanted to do. And it goes back to what we were talking about before, John. This is why I don't like him and why I have a hard time giving him credit for anything now, because there is a part of human history that is awful, and it is solely attributed to him. And the man wouldn't even own up to it in the court cases. I don't have any respect for a human being who can at least own up to something they did, especially something that cost somebody their life.
Two children. I mean,
two children this, and Vic Morrow. Yeah. God bless him. He was trying to do the right thing. There are people who were on that set that day that said he, like, they could see him trying to cover those children as that helicopter crashed down on them.
Yeah. So essentially, if you haven't seen it, just briefly, it's a guy who's very bigoted and racist, and he ends up in a Twilight Zone-y kind of thing. He gets teleported to different places. He's like in the Old South, and people see him as an African American, and he's like
in Nazi Germany as a Jewish.
In Nazi Germany, people see him as a Jew, right? And so he looks like him, but when he gets teleported to these places, people see him as that.
Like a quantum leap kind of thing.
That's right. Yep. The scene we're talking about took place in Vietnam. And to try to soften his character, who is this bigot, as he's starting to realize the error of his ways, like, let's have him do something heroic and save these two orphans.
It's like a Scrooge moment, right? It's the waking up and having gone through the horrors and now realizing you need to be a different person.
Yeah. And I know we're just focusing on this accident from this film, but frankly, that has overshadowed the film for me, knowing what happened in the film. It's like, it's so much less important, the film. It's like real life. And to your point, Landis did make decisions. Like, I won't even enumerate them. You could do a whole backtrack talking about the story of this.
But Wikipedia page on this thing.
He didn't have a teacher or a tutor on set. They weren't supposed to work at night, all these different things. And he made decisions to get it done in unsafe conditions, without the right safety things, without the right practices. They had one take to get it, whatever, and the worst possible thing happened. Right.
And it wasn't even that there were a bunch of yes men around him saying, oh, sure, boss, we can do it that way. There were people actively arguing against his decisions on set.
He's like,
I'm
the boss.
He was sending home and firing and all kinds of horrible stuff. I mean, this film made me feel as though Landis is a megalomaniac, especially later on. There's a film we're going to talk about where he got into some pretty hot arguments with his star that kind of also perpetuate that theory. But this one had the most tragic and horrible consequences imaginable in any. Nobody should ever die making a movie.
I don't disagree with any of that.
You've got to think there were probably Landis and others, lots of people in that era made lots of stupid decisions that just didn't lead to something this terrible happening. And they got away with it.
You know what I mean? Yeah, it just caused a lot of changes in the whole industry.
And had that helicopter crash not happened, we'd have never heard about Landis doing it, quite honestly. But we did. It came out.
Again, a film, like you said, John, overshadowed by tragedy, and rightfully so overshadowed by tragedy at this point. But there was some good storytelling going on that was born out of the original Twilight Zone series. So I have to give the original series the credit for the story. And I'm going to give Landis the blame for what happened.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
And just from the segment he did, I didn't particularly care for it anyway, to be quite honest, just because I thought the story was just not good. There was no subtlety about it at all. There was nothing.
It was not subtle. Right. I mean, they were working from an original script and re-envisioning it, but it was very little subtlety, as you said. Yeah. It was very
you got to feel that was probably put together hastily. There was probably a lot of execs going, shouldn't we
Mm-hmm. was include this in the film at that time.
Together.
Yeah, there were questions whether you released the whole movie at one point.
Right. And I mean, I know that being a student of film history, directors almost always say one of the most important elements of a film is the editing. And there's no way the editing really was able to be done on that segment, because who wants to watch those scenes and then try to make something out of it?
Yeah. I just don't want to go through it. Yep.
Yeah.
One more segment coming. We're going to turn to a lighter note. We have three late 80s comedies, all directed by Landis. We're going to talk about right after this break. We'll see you on the other side.
You know, a lot can happen in 7 minutes, and luckily, that's how long it takes me to tell a story. My name is Aaron Califato, and I'm the creator of 7 Minute Stories. I'm proud to partner with Evergreen Podcasts, and I'd like to invite you to join me on this journey. I'm going to take you on some crazy roller coaster rides using my unique extemporaneous storytelling style, and together, we're going to try to make sense of the world, all through the art of storytelling, and all in approximately 7 minutes.
If you're a diehard Gen X grown-up, you can pledge your support by clicking join on YouTube or by becoming a patron at genxgrownup.com/patreon.
Let's ride!
The Three Amigos. They were the biggest stars of their day.
The Three Amigos are history.
But that was yesterday.
Look, boys, I know show business. Something always turns up. Telegram for the Three Amigos.
Whew, okay. That was some heavy talk before.
Yeah.
I mean, and we needed to. I mean, honestly, it deserved it. I mean, let's be
you
honest.
You can't talk about it and not talk about it.
It absolutely
that,
deserved
right?
it. But the movies that he made in the late 80s were as far from that as you're going to get. I mean, they were all like these lighthearted, kind of goofy sort of films. And the first one we're going to talk about was in 1985, which starred Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd. It's called Spies Like Us. with
God,
not a great movie, in my opinion. I didn't like it when it first came out. Got a Rotten Tomato score of 32. And for people who have not seen it and can avoid seeing it now, it's basically two bumbling government employees think they're U.S. spies, only discover they're actually decoys for nuclear war. Yeah, it was a waste of talent, actually, in my opinion.
Let me tell you, this is the first film I ever fell asleep in the theater watching. I went with friends.
It's a comedy. And that is like the worst. That's like a kiss of death for a comedy.
And so now, of course, decades later, I'm like, I'm going to do a podcast about this movie. I'm going to watch the whole thing. And I watched the whole thing. And about three quarters of the way through, I went, is there a story going on at all in this movie? And look, you have Dan Aykroyd, you have Chevy Chase. I mentioned Frank Oz shows up again, you know, from the land of Baba Hope makes a freaking cameo playing through. It's sketch comedy. It's more like Kentucky Fried Movie than anything else. It's a bunch of little sketches. Let's do a sketch of them doing a surgery. Let's do a sketch of them greeting each other. Doctor, 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 doctor.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of goofy little things about them in training, about them taking a test. And it wasn't until the very end that there was even a story, and it wasn't even a good story. And one more thing. I think this was a linchpin for me. I don't think I like Chevy Chase. Mm-hmm. I think I don't like the actor now that I've seen this.
Yeah.
You know, this was one of the original seven. So when I first bought a DVD player, I remember telling you guys I got seven free DVDs. Uh-huh. This was one of the ones
set. Okay. I'm sorry.
So I watched this one multiple times because when you get a DVD player and you have seven DVDs, what do you
It looks
do.
Awesome.
You're going to watch them over and over again. I didn't dislike this movie quite as much as John did, but I admit this is not a good film. Mm-hmm. Rotten Tomatoes 32 might be generous.
Yeah.
It was cheesy. It was hokey. Dialogue was stilted and terrible. I agree with John. I don't like Chevy Chase either. He's got one film that I like of his that I can think of, National Lampoon's Vacation.
Vacation.
What about Caddyshack? He was good in that.
I don't consider that a Chevy Chase film. He's in it. That's not a Chevy Chase film to me. That's a Bill Murray film.
Mm-hmm.
It's an okay film. It's one that we can spend as little time as possible discussing. It was a John Landis film in the late 80s. It was a comedy. There was a couple of big boobs and Dan Aykroyd's wife in the movie. So
it was, to me, it was a buddy movie that never was a buddy movie.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be
they
a buddy movie.
They didn't seem to blend very well, did they?
Yeah.
No.
Now that you mention it.
They never clicked. So let's move on.
I had one laugh out loud moment. I'll give it credit. Right after they parachute down and they get in a little fight with the guy who's training them.
Oh, yeah. Bernie Casey.
And he goes, what is that? It's a Dickfer. What's a Dickfer? It's what you pee with.
Right.
What a dad joke. And I laughed out loud.
All right. Got one.
There's too much to not like about this one. The only thing I want to say is you talked about they didn't gel well together. Aykroyd and Murphy gelled perfectly together. Aykroyd and Chase, nope.
No, not at all.
Chevy Chase and his punchable face, that jerk. I don't like him. Okay. Let's move on to another ensemble piece. 1 year later, 1986, The Three Amigos.
Why are we going to move on to this one? We just said we don't like Chevy Chase.
Well, he was in it. Well, what can we do?
Here we are.
I did like the other two people that were the Three Amigos, the other two thirds.
Right. Yeah, Steve Martin and Martin Short.
Yes.
That's right.
Awesome.
All right. And it starts, you think it's about actual these Spanish bandito guys, but none of them are Spanish. Like, what's going on? Well, it turns out it's about three actors who accept an invitation to a Mexican village to perform their on-screen bandit fighter roles, not knowing they're really being asked to come and help the village by people who think they're real. And so
they
think they're acting. Cool premise. Yep. And I love the names of the three guys: Lucky Day, Ned Niederlander, and Dusty Bottoms. They're just great names for the characters.
So, John, I want to point out, we talk about not liking Chevy Chase. I don't think Steve Martin and Martin Short like him either.
Well, I guess not, because they're doing a thing now, aren't they?
Exactly. John, yeah. One of John's favorite TV series that's going on right now is Steve Martin and Martin Short. Chevy Chase nowhere near it. So I'm guessing maybe they don't like him
actually,
either.
Steve Martin and Martin Short even have a touring show they do now.
Mm,
yep. Without Chevy Chase, obviously.
And no Chevy Chase on the bill at all.
So are we going to talk about Landis' involvement in this movie? Because, I mean, it wasn't a great film. What was the Rotten Tomatoes on this, John? Do you know?
45. And
wow, that's generous.
Yeah, that's way generous.
I would tend to agree. I just rewatched it. Watching it now, I'm not sure if I ever watched it from beginning to end before. Like, I know I saw it. It was on HBO a million times, and I saw pieces of it.
Right.
I'm not sure I watched it from beginning to end until now. And it didn't make it any more cohesive, honestly. It was still kind of, motivations were questionable a bit in it. And I hate to be crapping on these, what I thought were seminal 80s films, and now I'm not so sure that they are, but that's how I felt about it, rewatching it now.
Yeah, but we were kids. Everybody saw this movie.
Of course.
You know? I mean, yeah. So when you say like seminal movies, I mean, not all landmark movies had to be good, I guess, you know? It's just that they were popular. Everyone wanted to go see them, even though they weren't awesome, quite honestly.
I don't think this one's in any danger of being included on the AFI top 100 list.
No,
probably not.
You know, and Mo, back then I thought they were good movies, though. Mm-hmm. I think what I turned, maybe I liked, was I liked the one-liners. I liked the quotable stuff. I liked the goofy situations. But now that I've seen what movie has evolved into, I look back and I go, not just for the time, I know that cinematography and things have evolved, but even just storytelling, that's something that just isn't present in some of these films that landed. That he gets credit for being, you know, this great seminal director, and he's kind of just was a guy who made films in that era. He's not
he made a lot of films.
Great as I thought he was. Yeah, he did a lot of films.
Well, do we have anything that we can talk about in the late 80s? And I'm saying this with full knowledge that we do have one more film.
Thank goodness you didn't set me up for failure, right?
No, of course. That we can talk about that is at least something we could end with on some positive notes. So, yes, we do. I'm going to announce it. Coming to America, 1988, Rotten Tomatoes score 73, deserves way higher than 73.
I think it should be higher, for sure.
Yep.
88 probably on my index, maybe 90. Mm. I'll give you the synopsis. An extremely pampered African prince travels to Queens, New York, and goes undercover to find a wife that he can respect for her intelligence and strong will. If you don't know, there's a sequel. Just came out a year or so ago during the whole COVID thing that was pretty funny as well. This is one of those films that, in my mind, regardless of who directed it or not, it was an Eddie Murphy film. I don't it wasn't a John Landis film, in my opinion. It's an Eddie Murphy film.
I mean,
So, I mean, do you base that on what you saw in the film or other things that you have learned since then, or a combination?
Probably a combination. So I think you could have had any director on set and this movie is still as good as it is. Mm-hmm. That's my first opinion. Second opinion, there have been a couple of different documentaries that I've watched since then about the making of Coming to America, especially stuff that came out when Coming to America with the two number.
Yeah, the sequel.
When that came out, people were revisiting the old film. There was apparently several huge fights on set between Murphy and Landis that I alluded to earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And Murphy won every argument because the studio basically said, Landis, shut up. It's Eddie fucking Murphy.
Yeah, let him do his thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was at the height of his career at that point, 88.
Oh, yeah, he was. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about the Kentucky Fried Movie, which was a series of sketches that were not connected. We just talked about Spies Like Us, which I felt was like a series of unconnected sketches. Coming to America is also a series of sketches. You have repeating sketch of the guys in the barbershop. Mm-hmm. You have what's going on at McDowell's or McDougal's. Right. What's the
McDowell's,
right?
Yep. McDowell's,
McDowell's,
yeah.
Right? The knockoff of McDonald's. You have sexual chocolate, right? Yeah. That boy, good. Right? You have so much in it, but all of those are connected. They're actually woven into the story here. They're not little standalone sketches. They all play into each other, which you can see, maybe you can see some of Landis's fingerprints on this, some of his earlier films, because of how it's structured. But the structure is so much more mature, and maybe that's or the collaborators, or maybe it's because Eddie Murphy, you know, smoothed it over. I don't know. But it's a evolved version of what we saw in some of his earlier films, it seems to me.
So for me, I think the one thing that this film has over a lot of the others that we've talked about, not all of them, but a lot of them, it has heart. We talk about that. It's an intangible thing to describe, but this film has heart. There are even some nice callbacks at the very end when he and Lisa McDowell are walking back to his apartment along the riverfront and he sees two bums sitting on the pier.
Oh, yeah.
He
yeah.
hands them a Trading big Places. Paper bag full of cash and it's the two, you know, yep. it's the two old guys from Trading Places.
We're back.
We're back. So, yes, obviously there are great scenes in this movie that I get why you say it's like segments, John, but Eddie Murphy's character and his heart and his through line and the love story with trying to find the love of his life versus the princess who hops on one leg and barks like a dog for
although she was pretty hot, but
two movies she was pretty hot and I would have taken her. I wouldn't have gone to Queens, but I mean, it was, it's still to this day of the films on this list, it's my favorite by far. It's not even close.
Yeah it does stand up. It's one, like many of these that don't, it's one that does stand up. It got a sequel, which was a great sequel, fun to watch. So I think we've established that George is not going to give Landis any credit for anything he did because it's tarnished what he has. But
yeah,
I mean, he was involved in all of this. The odd thing is you could say, hey, he was involved in all these great films, but they're not all great films. No. Now that I look back on them, they were films that were touchstones. They were landmarks that you remember. I remember when that came out. I remember Twilight Zone. I remember Spies Like, I remember Falling Asleep at Spies Like Us.
Right. But I remember like when Trading Places came out, Blues Brothers. I mean, I remember.
Of course. Oh yeah.
Those were all big movies at the time. I still remember that.
They were. Yeah.
And I think I agree. It's like his, I don't know, it's like a lot of these don't stand up well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe it's the dialogue, maybe it's the fact that they're not like, we want more stories now. I think we expect more from movies that we that this didn't deliver on, except for a few cases. But they were important movies to me as I was growing up.
They were.
I think the one thing I can say to kind of summarize my opinion of Landis, because that's what the podcast is supposed to be about in this episode, is Landis, is his reputation to me was falsely earned. I think the majority of what was good in his films had more to do with the talented people in the films than with him. And I think what was mostly wrong in a lot of his films, especially the horrible tragedies, was solely laid at his feet. I know that that may not be a fair opinion because, you know, like you said, John, if you give him credit for the good things, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Well, I don't remember your exact opinion, quote.
Whatever you said. No, yeah. I got you.
But I don't think his reputation is fairly earned.
Well, what do you think in hindsight now? We've spoken at length for the last hour about Landis, films. So what's your takeaway? How do you feel?
I do believe in separating the person from what they produce, like the art from the artist, as much as I can. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, I mean, we talked about there's some things that happened that it seems like a shame to tarnish everything that he did. When he said there's a lot of people on these films that did a lot of great work, that they were still good movies, even though the person who did them maybe wasn't so great. I just think that the movies, I think they just, in general, they weren't very sophisticated, which is not a, like, and when you're in a teenager, you don't care, that's fine.
You know? Good point.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. But now you look back, like the ones that it seems like we liked the best were the ones that had the most story, had the most heart in it, you know, most cohesive. And that's what we kind of look for today. So I think for that reason, they just didn't stand up very well.
Yeah. I'm going to withhold judgment until I've had a chance to see Schlock, because that's a piece of his...
It's a piece of his filmography
that I've not seen yet. It might tie it all together, right? Yeah. It's the thread that runs through it. Yeah, it definitely, I look at him now as being a very almost infamous director, other than famous director. It's like he was so tarnished, and now knowing what we know, you know, how he took responsibility or didn't, you know, in light of that. Yeah, it's, I mean, worth talking about. It's like you talk about everyone regardless of their role because they had an impact on our Gen X youth. And so this has been our look at those Gen X films of John Landis. So, hey, fourth listener, let us know what you think, either about the films themselves or the director. We'd love to hear. It's a fourth listener email. You know how to hit us up. Before we get out of this show, I do want to take a quick second to welcome a brand new financial supporter over on Patreon. I want to welcome Dave A.
Hey
Dave, welcome. Hey. Thank you so much.
Welcome, Dave.
He just joined us at that $3 level. He loves the stuff we do, and he said we want to show his support, help keep gas in the tank, and man, you have done it. Thank you so much for your support. Thank you to you and everyone who supports us, whether it's on Patreon or over on YouTube. It means so much to us. And hey, you look in the show notes. If you want to join Dave, we'd love to have you along for the ride. That's going to wrap it up for this Backtrack. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another one. Hope to see you there. And a regular edition of our show is coming your way next Thursday. Until then, I am John. George, thank you so much for being here.
Yes, sir.
Mo, you know I appreciate you.
Man, always fun, man.
Fourth listener, it's you, though, we all appreciate most of all. And we will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
See you guys.
Take care, everybody.
No
Gen X Grown Up is a member of the Evergreen Podcast family. Learn more at evergreenpodcasts.com. Washing shows till sunrise. Unacceptable for grown-ups. Your dinner cannot
just be french fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown-up. I'm good on the promo.
Okay.
All right. Promo in 5, 4, 3.
Boy, that promo does not fit.
No, but no. Reread it, right? I didn't say great movies. I didn't say
I didn't say
iconic movies. I said they were landmarks.
They were
things we remember in our youth. I didn't say, what a great guy.
It just sounds way more positive than what we just delivered.
I tried to be as neutral as I could while still hyping the show.
Yep.
I'm Allison Holland, host of the Kennedy Dynasty podcast. Equipped with a microphone and a long-term fascination of the Kennedy family, I am joined by an incredible cast of experts, friends, and guests to take you on a fun, relaxed, yet informative journey through history and pop culture. From book references to fashion to philanthropy to our modern expectations of the presidency itself, you'll see that there is so much more to Kennedy than just JFK or conspiracy theories. Join me for the Kennedy Dynasty podcast.